call to order the House Committee on Human Services today, February 9th, 2009. We have very ill people around. Representative Van Orman is going to go up to her office and watch the rest of this on her television. I'd like to ask people to turn off their cell phones and please turn them off completely, not just on mute, because they affect the sound system. Your BlackBerries also, please turn them off completely. Thank you. Thank you for joining us, Representative, and
thank you.
Go get better. Okay, we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2138. Keeley?
This bill updates language and definitions related to continuing care communities. It provides for increased disclosure of operating expenses, fees, financial status, and Medicare and Medicaid provider status to residents of these homes. It also provides for the rights of residents in a continuing care community, including the establishment of a resident council and resident representatives to the community governing board.
Great. Thank you. So, Ruth Gullius and Mary Geer and Scott Ferguson.
Go ahead. I think Mary was going to start us off.
Okay.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee.
Good morning.
My name is Mary Geer. I'm the administrator for the Office of Licensing and Quality of Care in the Seniors and People with Disabilities Division, Oregon Department of Human Services. My office has policy and program responsibility for the continuing care retirement communities. We're here this morning to talk about House Bill 2138. This bill is quite an extensive overhaul of the statutes related to continuing care retirement communities. This proposal is the work of a CCRC advisory council that came together after the last full legislative session to look at how to best preserve consumer protection for those people who choose to go into continuing care retirement communities. These communities are those that provide services for people throughout different levels of care and often throughout the scope of someone's life. I know Ruth will talk a little bit more about how CCRCs work and such. The current statutes regulating CCRCs had not been reviewed for many years, and as I say, this advisory council worked very hard to review the entire statute and to make a number of suggestions about how to best protect consumers of CCRC services. This bill proposes to update the statute to reflect current practices. It strengthens the disclosure requirements for CCRCs so that people who are entering CCRCs to receive services and supports understand what it is that they're getting. It gives them more information so that they can make informed decisions. It expands the department's ability to revoke a registration if a CCRC is not abiding by the guidelines and statute. And it also provides a resident's bill of rights for consumers in continuing care retirement communities. The department supports the changes to these bills. I know that Ms. Gullius is going to speak to a couple of tweaks and definitions and such that we've been discussing and are very comfortable that we can come to agreement and put those in place. There is quite a bit of support for these changes, and I just want to add my thanks to the Advisory Council for the good work that they did on this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions for this witness? All right. Thank you very much.
Well, good morning. My name is Ruth Gullius, and I am the Executive Director of the Oregon Alliance of Senior and Health Services, representing not-for-profit providers of quality housing and services throughout the state. And within my membership, I have 11 CCRCs throughout the state of Oregon. First off, I really want to thank the committee for allowing what I think was a very thoughtful and inclusive process to debate the many issues that were contained in the review and the discussion of the CCRC Advisory Council that took place over the last year. We were before you the last regular session on this bill, and we had were supportive of the reconvening of a CCRC advisory council to really debate the many issues, because the council consists of three provider representatives, importantly three consumer representatives, a CPA, and a member of the business community that has management expertise. We thank the department for reconvening the CCRC advisory council, and then the council for meeting and really giving a good discussion with testimony throughout the course of their meetings. The deliberations and their recommendations are the results of what we see in the bill. And with that, we're supportive of that bill, and just want to thank all that were involved for what we think has been a good outcome that really increases transparency and disclosure of information that can help consumers make informed decisions. So thank you.
Thank you, Ruth. Any questions?
Madam Chair, do we expect a fiscal on this?
I don't know.
Chair Tomei and Representative Maurer, we do not expect that there is any fiscal impact.
That's a good thing.
That's a very good thing. Very happy to hear that. Good news. Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Callan.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm whomever amongst the presenters, but I think it would be helpful if we could go through a little more detail on exactly what changes are being brought about by this bill. I admit that I haven't had a chance to read it completely, but I'm a little confused.
Mary, can you do that for us, or should somebody else do that?
Well, I can go ahead and
go ahead.
Start. I think the major change, there's a lot of cleanup changes, I think, that Mary Gear spoke to, because the statute was reviewed by Department of Justice, so they had several changes that they had recommended that the council entertained. The biggest one related to consumer participation, and it's this bill would require, and this would be a new requirement, that there be a non-voting representative on the board of the CCRC. That is one of the biggest changes. Mary spoke to residents' rights and responsibilities. That is a brand new section. Many of the elements within that are contained in other licensing statutes, and I think it was the belief of the council and the department that those rights should flow through various different licensing and registration requirements for long-term care. So they were included in this. There's several process and information-related clauses related to the types of information that should be released and included within the disclosure statements. There was a whole host of things listed in them, but they've been added to.
Chair Tomei and Representative Cowan, if I might just add, CCRCs have evolved a lot in the time that they've been in existence, and I believe they started as a model where it was more of a closed campus, and a resident would have a membership fee and perhaps a monthly fee and continue to receive services on whatever part of that campus met their service needs. We've had a lot of changes, and we now have different licensed entities that sit within a CCRC. So we register the entire continuing care retirement community, but there might be a licensed assisted living building in that CCRC. There might be a licensed nursing home in that CCRC. And it is also possible then that nursing home might be open, which means that people who have not paid a membership fee to the CCRC might come and receive services at the nursing home. And so really part of the charge of the advisory council was to take into account all the different permutations of a CCRC to make sure that consumers know what it is, what kind of a campus they're getting, they're choosing, and to understand what that means for the choices that they make. And then also, how can the department ensure that consumers are best protected and we know what it is that we're registering and consumers have information about that.
Anything more, Representative Cowan, or you?
I think it gives me an idea.
Okay.
Just trying to catch up here a little,
right.
I guess. It is Monday, you understand.
I do understand completely. All right. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Scott Ferguson. I'm the executive director of Capital Manor Retirement Community, which is a continuing care retirement community located across the river in West Salem. I'm also the chair of the state CCRC advisory committee. And I also want to thank the department for reinstituting the committee. I was part of the original committee in 1990 that developed the first rules and regulations and rules, and we had not reviewed that for 18 years. Been a few changes along the way. So this gave us an opportunity to review the entire regulation and a lot of words that needed to be changed. But we also had very open discussion at our committee meetings about the issues that were brought forth that brought this bill to our committee. We had a total of 12 hours of work on this committee. That's just at the committee level. There were many other hours off that time. We had open discussion for six of those hours where we heard both sides of issues, and we heard them extensively. And then the committee was charged with presenting this bill. So in the last meeting, we had open and frank discussion about what should be in the bill and what shouldn't be in the bill. And in cases where we could not reach a consensus, we had a vote. And this is the outcome of that committee vote. It was a good process. I know that we kept our members, the nonprofit CCRCs, of which I think there are 11, and three for-profit CCs. We asked them to participate. They chose not to. And we tried to draw into this bill things that would be a transparency not only for nonprofits, which is a little easier because we have to file 990s and our books are pretty open, and for-profits, which don't have to do those things. So we have put in that there'd be resident representatives. If they don't have a resident council, they don't have a board of directors, then they'll meet with the owners or the regional manager or whomever and share information that way. So we are very in favor of this bill. We think it meets all the needs that were expressed and have really no concerns about it.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of things. Is there any kind of a list, and speaking for probably a couple of us up here being new to this committee, is there a list of problems or complaints or reasons why the work group was reconvened?
Representative Huffman and members of the committee, I know Mary can speak to this, but when we were here 2 years ago, there weren't any real concerns that had been raised over a period for many years, and I don't know what has occurred between now and then.
Chair Tomei and Representative Huffman, there were no major complaints or concerns that had been raised. There are several gentlemen sitting behind me who were very much a part of the bill that came before the last regular legislative session that raised some significant concerns at a CCRC in which they are interested. And that really prompted the department to say, you know, we haven't looked at these rules for 18 years. It's really time we did that and updated them. So it did give us the opportunity to not only update to current practice, but to identify the things where we maybe didn't have major concerns or problems, but that were difficulties for us in the registration or in the disclosure, or things that we were hearing from the consumer members of the advisory council that really needed to be upgraded.
And I think we'll be hearing from someone after
this. I was going to say, thank you. It sounds like we'll get a little more maybe background on it.
Right.
Another question?
Sure.
Kind of
a
follow-up to Representative Maurer. I believe Representative Maurer was probably referring to fiscal impact to the state or DHS. Is there any fiscal impact to the consumer or the resident?
No, there would not be.
Any further questions? Yes, Representative Denver.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the concerns that I've heard expressed over CCRCs, I mean, what separates, I think, the good ones from the not-so-good ones has to do with the continuity of the caregivers, or looked at it the other way, the rates of turnover of staff. And I wonder, you know, is that something that this process will help us to monitor or to figure out ways that turnover levels can be kept down? Because I know it's just from personal experience, it can be very disruptive for the clients.
Well, those are covered under other statutes, like the regulations for nursing homes. They have mandatory minimum hours for nurses and nurses' aides per patient. This bill does not address that because it's addressed somewhere else.
Yeah. I'm not, if I can follow up, thank you. I'm not so much concerned now with staffing ratios, but more just maintenance of personnel, strategies for preventing high turnover.
Chair Tomei, Representative Dembrow, we have many of our CCRCs, particularly they have different license levels of care, nursing, assisted living, residential care. Many of our members are involved in several grant projects that really are related to trying to work on culture within the organization that really enhances the staffing component and the quality of life within the committees, a lot of that being directed to staff training and some standardized curriculum. So they are involved in that through some of their own mission-directed efforts.
Chair Tomei and Representative Dembrow, there has been a lot of research nationally about staff turnover in long-term care that has done a very good job of identifying the factors that contribute to high turnover and low turnover, and they are quite varied. And they range from things like the level of supervision and professionalism of the direct supervisor to wages, benefits, child care, transportation, all of those kinds of things. And so when we talk about affecting staff turnover rates, which, as you say, is a very direct has a very direct correlation to quality of care. We really have to talk about all of those things and how to influence them, starting with Medicaid reimbursement rates, private pay reimbursement rates, and then all of the things that support the workforce. And in all honesty, what I'm hearing from many providers, Scott can probably speak to this better than I can, is that difficult economic times actually contribute to lower staff turnover and a more available workforce.
And if I just one last follow-up, thank you. So, you know, I think it would be looking back at an experience that we had gone through where my mother-in-law was in a CCRC, which was a lovely facility and very well put together, and we were really attracted to the caregivers. They really enjoyed them, and they seemed very, very competent and capable. But within a year, none of the direct caregivers were there anymore, and that you know ultimately influenced our decision to leave that facility and go somewhere else. But I'm wondering if it would have been possible for us as we were checking out the various facilities in the first place to know what the turnover ratio was, if that's information that's given to the consumer. And if not, I would suggest that would have been very useful for us.
Chair Tomei and Representative Dembrow, I would just point out that there is a federal effort to identify quality indicators for nursing facilities on the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services website that includes staff turnover for nursing facilities. It's taken many years for CMS to get to the point where they can report that and clearly see that as an important thing. It would be a state effort to report staffing turnover levels at all of the state licensed facilities like assisted living and residential care and foster homes and our developmental disability 24-hour residential programs.
And if we were to ask for that, that would create a fiscal
Chair Tomei,
responsibility.
No doubt it would.
Yes. So, Okay, thank you. And did anyone here have amendments that you wanted to offer or are concerned about amendments?
We have we're working with the department on some two minor amendments that were really reflect language that came out of the CCRC Advisory Council that didn't quite get carried over that we've been in agreement on.
Great. So we'll see those before too long.
Yes.
Okay. Any further questions of these witnesses? Thank you all very much. Thank you for coming. So we have, excuse me, Jack Caldwell and Joe Greenman. And is there anyone else who wishes to speak on this bill? Seeing none. I think we saw you a couple of years ago.
Madam Chair, I was sitting here, and these gentlemen were here 2 years ago.
That's right.
Yes.
And the more I looked at them, this picture in my mind came back and said, you almost sat exactly in the same position.
I think you're right. It's good to see you here again.
Thank you, Chair Tomei, and members of the committee. I'm John C. Caldwell, known as Jack, and I'm a pioneer resident of Mary's Woods. And we were here 2 years ago, and just parenthetically answer one of the questions about, you know, what are the problems at Mary's Woods. We have had some very severe problems of transparency, getting information, and resistance on the part of management to that. The Alliance takes a different view, fortunately, and this is a consumer protection bill, though. And it improves the present statute by bringing the disclosure requirements up to date and improves the input from residents concerning decisions that affect their lives, because this is where we live now. This is and where we will live, most of us, the rest of our lives. A person who invests $3,000 in a mutual fund gets more disclosure than you ever want to read. I'm sure you've seen those. And then you keep getting it. Under the present statute, a person who puts $300,000 in as an entry fee in a continuing care retirement community receives very little initial disclosure in terms of comparing with what you get in a security, and almost no continuing disclosure. This statute corrects that problem. I use the term investment advisedly because much of the money that goes into CCRCs comes from entry fees. And, for example, at Mary's Woods, the project cost about $90 million, and $60 million of that came from residents' entry fees. The bill is a culmination of an effort that started in the 2005 legislature with a kind of a quickie bill to try to get people's attention a little bit. And in the last session, the bill that was introduced resulted in this committee asking DHS to renew the CCRC Advisory Council, which was done and which has been a very good thing. The Advisory Council, DHS, interested providers, and residents all had input into this bill. It isn't perfect, but it's a great improvement over what we have had. It brings it up to date. We at Mary's Woods were blessed with the leadership and wise counsel of Senator Mark Hatfield, who, unfortunately, because of his health, has had to move away and go to a warmer clime. But in a letter to Speaker Minnis in 2005, he pointed out the effect of management decisions, and I quote from what he wrote. He said, "The actions of management in a community such as this affect not only our finances, but our future care, and our entire lives." We thank you for this opportunity, and we thank Mary Geer and for her work and that of her division. They've been just wonderful, and we do appreciate the fact that the Alliance and the Advisory Council, represented by Mr. Ferguson, have been in favor of this. If you have any questions, I'll do my best to answer them. Now, behind me are my colleagues, Kim Allison, Dick Goff, and Bill Campbell. And Dick and Kim were here 2 years ago. Bill is a new inmate at Mary's Woods. But he is on the advisory council.
Terrific. Thank you so much for coming today, and thank you for bringing this issue to our committee 2 years ago and enabling us to see that the Department of Human Services was able to follow up on this. So thank you for all your work and the work of all the other people who brought this to the committee. Representative.
Thank you, Boone. Madam Chair. Mr. Caldwell, when you first came to Mary's Woods and signed on, basically, and forked over the money, is it a contract, or does it tell you at that point what you get for your money?
Yes and no. I mean, in the sense, excuse me, Chair Tomei, members of the committee, it's a contract you sign, and I, as a longtime lawyer, read the contract. I also knew that what they were trying to do, saw their mission statement. I didn't receive a disclosure statement, even though we were supposed to get them, but that was the problem of an incompetent management firm that the Sisters of the Holy Names had hired, and they just weren't complying with things. But we didn't dream that we wouldn't be told anything, or that the residents, who have a lot of experience in business and professions, would be just shut out from knowing things. One of the early meetings, when we were told your rates are going to go up 5%, bingo, your monthly fees, we asked for some detail and were told by the chief financial officer, well, we haven't decided yet how much we're going to tell you. And as I mentioned, we've had other places that we've checked with have had various problems. Mary's Woods has had them all. So we're working through them, and we think things have improved, but we think this bill is a big help.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Cowan.
Thank you. And thank you for coming back. It's good to see you all again. I'm dredging my memories from 07 and trying to remember some detail. And as I recall, there was a question about how depreciation was figured into the overall fee structure. And it looks to me like this bill essentially puts a resident in the meetings as part of the decision making, but would not necessarily change some of the decisions that you might or might not agree with around things of that nature. Am I correct in my reading?
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, yes, you are correct. It does not change that. The depreciation issue is still an issue. It was debated rather roundly in the advisory council, and it was determined to leave that alone because it's not just a fiscal issue. It seems to be an emotional issue with a lot of people as to whether it should be or not. But we're still being charged for non-cash expenses, and in the contract it didn't really say that as I understood it, but the depreciation issue is not involved here.
Okay.
That's why I said the bill isn't perfect from our viewpoint, but it's a great improvement.
Thank you.
Good memory, Representative Callan.
Yeah.
Oh, do I get a gold star
yes,
this morning?
Yes, you
do. Yeah. Very good.
Any further questions? Thank you so much for coming, and thank you for being continue to be involved in this issue. Does anyone else wish to testify on this bill?
Yeah, sure.
All right, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2138 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2407. Keeley.
This bill provides a tax credit on interest paid on education loans at particular universities, if the result of that work was a degree in social work and the degree recipient is employed by a qualified public body or nonprofit organization for at least 6 months of the year. The tax credit is granted on a sliding scale based on the amount of hours you work and things like that, but does not exceed $2,000 annually.
Great. And we have a couple of people interested in testifying on this, Jessica Ritter and Stacy Scala Orr. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good
morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you today about House Bill 2407. My name is Jessica Ritter, and I am the chair of the Legislative Committee for NASW, National Association of Social Workers, Oregon, and I'm also a professor of social work here in Oregon. I feel really lucky because I have a wonderful job as a social work educator, and I get to work with college students every day who decide to commit themselves to a career in social work, which is really a career in service. However, one of the problems I see of many college students today is them dealing with the price or the college rates, the price of college, which has gone up pretty dramatically in recent years. And so a lot of our graduates are leaving college burdened by a lot of student loan debt. And this is even more dire for social work students, since most of them will start their career making, you know, salaries that are much lower than they should be. We know that from the Department of Labor that the demand for social workers is going to continue to increase over the coming decade, particularly in the areas of health care and mental health, as over 1 million veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan return. So we know that the demand is going to continue to be high for social workers, and one of the biggest problems facing the profession has to do with the recruitment and retention of social workers, though, due to a lot of challenges and you know, mostly having to do with salary issues. And one of the comments that I hear a lot from my students, which is a little disheartening, is, you know, I want to be a social worker, I want to major in social work, but all my friends and family tell me, don't be a social worker, you're not going to make enough money to support yourself, you're not going to make enough money to raise a family. So we really think that this bill goes a long way toward addressing the economic hardship of social workers in the state of Oregon. So let me just talk to you very briefly about House Bill 2407 and what it does exactly. It offers a tax credit for the interest that social workers pay on the principal of their student loans. This would be, the people that would be eligible for this would be social workers with a degree in social work from an accredited program. These are social workers who are employed in a variety of settings, public and nonprofit entities. And the tax credit ranges from $500, a low of $500, to a high of $2,000. And it basically provides an incentive for those social workers who are working in an area that's geographically underserved. Of course, a bill that could offer a much more generous form of student loan relief would be ideal. But we really think that this is a small but significant step to trying to ease the financial burden that social workers face in Oregon. And I'll just end by saying that we recognize that these are really tough times for the state economically, and this does have a fiscal impact to the state, a small one. But I hope that you would keep in mind that social workers are really going to be at the forefront of helping and aiding a lot of families who are dealing with the current recession and dealing with a lot of families dealing with unemployment and underemployment. So I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have, and thank you again.
Jessica, you mentioned a fiscal impact. Do you have any sense of what that might be?
I wasn't involved last session, but what my understanding is that there was a fiscal impact statement that was done last session, but it was done very late in the session and was very rushed. So what we would really prefer, if this could be moved to revenue to do another revenue impact statement, we would love to be involved in that. We also have some students from PSU who are working on a project where they're studying this bill, and they would certainly be involved with studying it as well. From what we understand, it was less than $1 million. I can't remember exactly what the exact number was, though.
Thank you, Jessica.
Sure.
Okay. Yes, question. Sorry.
Here in the note.
Yes.
Okay. Well, go ahead. If you, Andy.
Andy, did you have a question?
Yeah. Thanks, Madam Chair. Jessica, I'm just curious. What is the population for that students on this, or student population?
That's a great question. So do you mean if we're thinking about the impact of how many people exactly this would impact? I don't know the answer to that question. So I think that would be one of the things we would have to factor in and look at in the assessment. So I don't know.
Okay. Thanks.
Representative Boone?
I'm glad he asked that question as a segue into mine. And what I would like to see, and I think this is one of these bills we talked about and how we make policy in this committee, especially when it affects the bottom line, so to speak, and that is that we look at it in terms of, even though there may be a fiscal impact at this end, what's the impact at the other end, and it may end up that a little money put up front will save us a lot up there. So I don't know if that's possible. I know PSU students can do anything because I was one of them, but maybe they could factor that in their assessment and how many people they assume that they might be serving, what their needs might be in the future, and how this can help us do a preemptive strike.
Yeah. Thank you for that question.
Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. This is only on the interest of a loan. And if the interest of a loan, or if you have a $40,000 loan, student loan, mm-hmm. I'm not sure that you ever get up to, if you're paying $2,000 in interest, mm-hmm. you probably didn't negotiate your loan very well. I mean, I think, because this is not about your total loan payment, this is purely on the interest.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope they aren't misguided by using numbers like $2,000, because that would be an awful lot of interest on a student loan. Mm-hmm. I think it would be substantially less than that mm-hmm. on an annual basis.
So
and then, Madam Chair, the follow-up to this, mm-hmm. I would really be interested what you truly think the impact is going to be, because mm-hmm. I'm looking at this thinking, we're talking...
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not sure I'm going to make an employment decision based on $1,000 a year between Coos Bay and Vancouver, Washington. That may not be the difference in my decision to mm-hmm. be employed someplace. So.
Good point. Any further questions? I'm going to ask a question first, if I may. On line 24, if the taxpayers employed in a county with a population of 100,000 or less, do you know how many counties that would be?
I don't. Do you know, Stacey? Off the top of my head. We could certainly get back.
Okay, so when you come back, maybe you can have some answers for us in some of these questions. Representative Olson.
I'm good. Thank you.
Any further questions? Okay, go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Stacey Scala-Orr, and I'm the Executive Director of the National Association of Social Workers Oregon Chapter. NASW Oregon Chapter is comprised of 1,800 professional social workers, researchers, faculty members, and students. Many of our members work in community nonprofit agencies or public agencies providing a range of health, mental health, and social services to Oregon's residents. NASW urges your support of HB 2407 as an effective tool to recruit and retain qualified social work professionals, particularly in rural communities of Oregon. Social workers have unique skills and training to identify and develop strategies to meet the needs of the most vulnerable among us. Social work education enables students to integrate the knowledge, values, and skills of the social work profession for competent practice. Unlike many other academic disciplines, accredited social work programs require a minimum of 400 hours of supervised practice experience for baccalaureate programs and 900 hours for master's programs. As Jessica alluded to, financing a higher education is becoming increasingly difficult for many students, and certainly social work students are no exception. Many students must piece together a financial package from a variety of sources, but far too often, the majority of financial support does come from student loans. Among social workers and students who responded to a recent survey conducted by an ASW Oregon chapter, 78% of those surveyed reported borrowing $20,000 or more, and a little bit more than 25% reported borrowing $40,000 or more to finance their social work education program. Sadly, even greater financial difficulty awaits social workers once they graduate. After 4, 6, or sometimes more years of education, social workers are offered positions in both the public and private sectors that often fail to adequately reward them for their educational attainment, licensure, and credentials. Social work salaries continue to be among the lowest of degreed professions in general. But for those with master's degrees, the master's level educations in particular. While social workers may be in positions and often are in positions that are personally fulfilling, due to high loan debt and low income, many do struggle to make ends meet. For many of these dedicated professionals, the financial burden does become unmanageable, and they are forced to leave the field for positions that may be more financially rewarding. In these cases, it's a loss for the social worker, for the individuals, families, and communities they serve, and for society at large. In fact, it often means social workers with work experience are leaving challenging public sector jobs where their experience, we think, is needed most. Just an anecdote, maybe a few months ago, I received a call from one of our members, and she was calling to apologize because she was unable to renew her NASW membership. She just simply could not afford it. And she went on to actually inquire about whether or not there was any kind of loan relief or forgiveness programs and if we were pursuing this issue. And she shared with me that upon graduation, I believe she had approximately $38,000 to $40,000 in student loan debt that she had incurred, and her beginning salary in a public agency was approximately $32,000. And she was a single mother and was reflecting on her mortgage payment, trying to keep her house, her car payment, and also was her hours were reduced at her job. And I think she was just a textbook case of social workers finding themselves, and I think this particular legislation really does apply to those that are beginning in their careers, because that's when you are beginning to pay off your loans and when you are paying, especially on the interest that you accrued. And I hate to think the worst-case scenario. I did actually try to contact this member because I'd taken down her information, hoping she could come and share her story with you personally. But unfortunately, the phone number that she had given me was no longer connected. And I hear the story from many of our members, again, particularly those that are newer in the field. So student loan relief programs have been enacted across the United States for social workers to address the economic hardship of professionals in these highly critical but often low-paying jobs. HB 2407 is designed to benefit social workers who serve the public and carry significant loan debt. By doing so, we believe the interests of the state are served as well. The tax credits provided in this legislation will improve the ability of nonprofit and public agencies to recruit qualified social workers and, just as importantly, to retain them. The credits are structured to provide the greatest benefit to social workers and agencies who serve some of the smallest communities in the rural areas of our state where we are desperately in need of licensed social workers. Attached to my testimony is a handout that I believe further highlights the enormity of this problem in our state. Following the overview of the legislation, there's a graph, which I think sometimes an image can say 1,000 words. It's a comparing the median based on a workforce survey that we completed in 2008. It compares the median at graduation of starting income versus student loan debt, and we did adjust the figures to reflect 2007 dollars. And as you can see, the gray shaded amount is median income, starting income, and the reddish color is median debt. And what we have found is that not only have salaries gone down, but certainly the debt has increased. And in fact, now student loan debt exceeds the average starting salary of a social worker. As I look at this, I recall my first MSW position. It wasn't in the state of Oregon. It was in California, but it really mirrored this. I think my starting salary was about $34,000, and my debt was certainly higher than that. And it can be pretty daunting to face that coming out of your educational program, and certainly those loan payments kick in just 6 months after. Another significant finding that we found in this workforce survey alludes to a workforce shortage that we're very concerned about in our state. Of those surveyed, and we had about close to 900 survey respondents, out of those surveyed, 12.7 reported that within the next 3 to 5 years they were planning to leave the field of social work to seek a non-social work degree or a non-social work job. And there were other factors as well. An additional 8% are planning on retiring within the next 5 years. As I look at that 8.7% figure, I also am concerned as we look at the demographics of our profession. We're an older profession. A lot of people choose social work, I think, as second careers, and the average age of social workers is higher than our average just civilian labor force. And in looking at those demographics and the demographics of our membership, although we see enrollment rates steady at our social work programs, we have a huge percentage of our workforce that is moving towards retirement. And again, although our enrollment rates and our educational programs are strong and increasing, we are concerned about a retention factor when you start to look at the salary and student loan, the salary issues, and then the student loan debt they're facing. On the back side of the handout does list Oregon counties that currently have fewer than 50 licensed clinical social workers per capita. I know there was one question, and I don't think we can speak to it specifically, but these are a number of counties, some of which are under 100,000 in population, and there are some zeros out there as well. We did find one statistic from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services that estimates that Oregon's total number of social workers per capita is 135 per 100,000 population, ranking 34th among states. And just to highlight those that we did survey, although it is a small amount, it's a step towards some kind of loan relief that we can offer our social workers in the state where we currently don't have a program in place. And 97% of those who were surveyed did say they would be more likely to work or remain working for a public or nonprofit agency if they did receive some assistance with their student loans, and that two-thirds said it would be an incentive to work in rural or frontier counties. With that, I thank you for hearing HB 2407 today, and I urge the committee to consider moving this bill forward, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Stacy. Any questions of this witness, Representative
Olson?
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, Jessica or Stacy, either one of you can answer it. What are other states doing that's similar along the line that you're trying to pursue?
Do you want me to address that? Okay. Chair Tomei, Representative Olson, and members of the committee. In some research we prepared during the last session, we found that 31 states, including the District of Columbia, had some loan relief or repayment program. They probably all look a little bit different. In fact, that's one area we are asking our students that are working to help analyze this issue to also have an understanding as to what those programs look like. Some have managed to just write a line item to their state budget to provide loan relief. Some are based not only just on interest, but the principal of student loans. So there's a variation, but that was one finding that we had, that 31 of states do have some kind of loan relief programs for social workers specifically.
Follow up, Madam Chair. What's the success? Is there some measurement out there for how successful they've been with that then?
Chair Tomei and Representative Olson, members of the committee, that's an excellent question and one that we'd hope to look more into, and that we have our stellar students who are looking at this issue closely. I think that's a great question that we hope to be able to address.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Any further questions?
No, Madam Chair, I just want to stand corrected. I think that they probably would run up against
right.
the interest of the loan. So that depends, obviously, on your terms.
Mm-hmm. Right. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When, for either one of you, the study that's been referred to a number of times that is in progress right now, or we're going to pursue the study, or what's the status of it? Because it's interesting that we have a bill before us and not a lot of legislative time left, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we are working mm-hmm. on this. There's only a few months left. Please tell me. Anyway. When's the study going to be complete? Are we going to have that in time to actually address that data compared to?
I can probably address it if you like. Chair Tomei, members of the committee. I think the study itself we actually have completed. In the last session, a lot of the data we came to you with, we had done a small study specifically inquiring about the student loan debt faced by our members and at that time current social work students. We followed up that study based on some questions that we did receive during last session about more state-specific workforce demographics and findings. So we completed that study, a survey of Oregon social workers completed in fall of 2008. Analysis is still underway, and particularly as it relates to this issue, we're identifying we have, you know, the students we're working with have between now and we have our day of action, our lobby day, we bring students down to Salem on March 5th. So that's kind of the timeline to complete further analysis on this issue specifically. So the study itself has been done, but there's just been some follow-up analysis that's currently underway, and we certainly would have more information as it relates to what we think the fiscal impact would be, as well as some other looking at other states and the effectiveness of these programs, as well as some other questions that have arisen today that we can bring back.
So I don't think we have you scheduled for March 5th, but is that what you would like to do, is have more testimony on the March 5th, giving us answers to some of the questions that have arisen this morning?
Chair Tomei, thank you. Yes, before that would probably be ideal. On March 5th, this is certainly one of our legislative priorities for this session, but prior to then would be...
So when would you be ready with it for that?
Probably, knowing that, again, a lot of these... Do you mean specifically to follow up on some of the questions that have
right.
come out? Yeah, I think because the analysis is underway, I imagine maybe within a two-week period prior to the 5th, I don't know, the week before, ideally, I think we'd have some more information prepared by that time.
Okay, so I guess be in touch with us, and we'll try to schedule a time in there. That would be
okay.
fine. Colleagues, I don't know if you've had a chance to look at today's, I think it was in today's paper, about the high suicide rate mm-hmm. of returning veterans. And I think that gives even more impetus to us to find people who can be working with these folks as they come back from serving in Afghanistan and Iraq. And it's startling to see in some of these counties there are no social workers, and we know how difficult that is in the rural areas. Okay, I just want to say, add also that I'm MSW, and after I graduated, I was having my hair cut, and the woman who was cutting my hair mentioned that she also had MSW, and she couldn't make enough money, so she went into hairstyling. So that was not great news for me, but I've enjoyed my profession. And
look at you now.
Yeah, I'm looking at you now.
You're probably making
well,
even less.
I'm making even less. A lot less. That's true. Representative Cowan, you had a question?
Well, just a follow-up comment. I think that the... this is absolutely a branch of our healthcare workforce in general that we need to bolster. As I've been a member of a variety of committees, including the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug, we've heard these statistics repeatedly about the number of people leaving the profession and retiring and the replacement challenges. Recruitment and retention is becoming a huge problem throughout the healthcare spectrum, and I would suspect that a similar graph in terms of loan, total loan obligation to starting salaries would be much the same in virtually any healthcare profession, in up to and including MDs who are graduating with $150,000 to $200,000 debt. That's not unique anymore, so, and their starting salaries aren't making their debt load. So I think this is indicative of an issue that statewide we do need, nationwide we do need to look at across the healthcare spectrum, is the amount of personal commitment that goes into the education process in our healthcare professions, the debt load that folks are coming out with, and the ability to repay. I think from my just rough calculations, these not to exceed numbers that are proposed in this bill would pretty much cover all of the interest on everybody's debt. But whether or not that's enough to turn the tide in an arena that really needs some assistance and needs some more new people, I don't know. But I just needed to throw those thoughts into the conversation.
Thank you, Representative. And Representative Boone.
Thank you. And Representative Cowan pretty much mirrored what I was going to say, too. And I was, we have the rural physicians credit or whatever it is. And I know in rural areas it's even harder. And any kind of incentives that we can give people to move to these areas without a huge, I don't know how to say it, but I know I live in an area where it's recruitment is always an issue, and once you get someone in, you make things available to them, and people who already live there start thinking, hey, what about me? And we all live in this kind of depressed era right now, but we're really going to need these guys, and I know that we're going to, on the 23rd, we're going to hear some TBI bills, and maybe we could coordinate with these guys and people who will give us a little back before we get there, because I think that in veterans we're hearing about TBI too, and the returning
stands for,
excuse me, traumatic brain injury, and the returning vets from two wars and an escalation in another war that may include even more people than we are seeing now. So I think that, I guess what I'm trying to say is we need to be working together with these in terms of what Representative Huffman said. Our time is ticking away, and so we don't lose momentum or lose the opportunity to make these connections that we're going to need to make the decisions.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Denbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I really appreciate my colleagues' comments about the importance of thinking of education as a social good, a social investment, not just an individual investment. In the case of people going into this field, it's not a particularly good investment, right, if you're just looking at it as what it can do for your individual earning power. I'm wondering about the number of people that go into the areas that would be covered under this bill, you know, those who are working, you know, with in public or nonprofit entities who serve children, adults, you know, et cetera, in this group. How does that number compare, would you say, to the total number of people who get MSWs? Yes, is it a static number? Is it a changing number? Do you have any sense of that?
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, thank you for that question. There's a statute referenced here, and from what we understand, this is going to cover most of the working social workers out there. It basically covers social workers who work with children, families, the elderly, low-income people, health care, mental health care, vocational rehab, alcohol and drug abuse. So our sense of it is that this is going to cover most of the practicing social workers out there. There may be some that are not, but it basically covers social workers working in all of those fields if they work for a public or nonprofit entity.
Is that what you were asking for, Representative Denbrough?
Yes. I'm just wondering, if someone is working as a social worker at a hospital, let's say, where they may be getting a good salary, or actually I don't even know how their salaries in that kind of setting compare to someone who's working with low-income people for a nonprofit, for example. Would they fall into this group as well, or how might an MSW go into a more lucrative career field, as it were? So, and do they move in and out of, you know, from the more poorly paid working with low-income people to the more lucrative?
Right. Chair Tomei and members of the committee, it's a little bit of a complicated question. Let me see if I can do my best to answer that. the interesting thing about the social work profession is how diverse it is, and there's literally hundreds of settings you can work in as a social worker, all at different pay scales, certainly some fields a little more lucrative than others. I would probably say in the health field, higher salaries than in other fields. So certainly one of the kind of interesting things for someone being a social worker is that you can literally move around and do some. You can work in a school setting. You can decide you want to do hospital social work. You can work for DHS. So some social workers will dedicate their career to a certain field while others really do sort of move around. Certainly salaries go up in terms of working in, you know, working your way up into supervisory work or management, you know, getting into the more administrative side of things. But it's really hard. It's a hard question to answer.
Maybe you could find some more information regarding that.
Okay.
The next
sure.
time you come in.
Yeah, it sounds like that kind of factors into some of this other info that we'd like to gather for you. So we'll kind of add that in.
That's fine. Thank you.
Any further questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We hope to see you back again before too long.
Great. Thank you so much.
There's no one else here to speak. An empty room. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2407. And, colleagues, people are dropping like flies around here. I want you to stay healthy.
Okay,
wash
okay.
your hands thoroughly.
I'm very healthy.
I know you are, but we've had two members who are out ill. We didn't have one. A committee that I was on Thursday didn't even meet because too many people were ill.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
In the interest of public health, let me emphasize what you just said about washing your hands. I seriously had that advice from a long-term member of the legislature when I started here about obsessive hand-washing had kept him, helped him get through. It's something we all need to really think about.
Yes.
And
those little wipes.
And if you don't, I'll find that retired public health worker who will come in and give a demonstration of proper hand-washing technique, which takes a very long time.
It does.
Well, you can use the rub, you know, the alcohol rub,
right.
and you don't have to be very good and be very effective.
And use that on your doorknobs and on your phones.
It's a big difference.
Yeah, it's brutal. The problem is, I think this is going to go on because the people that weren't sick are going to, you know,
but
7 to 10 days later are going to...
If people who are sick would stay home, we wouldn't all get it.
So. And we wouldn't be able to have a quorum.
Yeah. That's right. That's why I want you to stay healthy. Anything else for the good of the order? I'll close the House Committee on Human Services, and I'll see you all on...